Today, on the Confessions of a Recovering Landlord podcast, How to Create the Perfect Office During a Pandemic, I'm Jan Gibbons, and I'd like to welcome you to our show. My sidekick, Bob Gibbons.
Hello.
Is here as usual. We're going to talk with our special guest, Mr. Andy Jones, president of Jones Commercial Interiors, to learn how you can make this happen. Established in 1996, Jones Commercial Interiors is one of Dallas's fastest growing and most innovative interior design firms. JCI's specialty is custom design of tenant spaces, including office, industrial, and retail. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Glad to have you.
Tell me how you and Bob met, anyway.
Do you remember that far back?
I do.
Is this a clean story?
When Bob was on the landlord side, and was I believe an asset manager for CMD.
Exactly, good memory.
We were his space planner. Our firm did the office design for the tenants in CMD buildings, probably in the 90s.
That would have been. I joined them in 95, and stayed with them through 2004. And I'm trying to remember. I think you were the architect or the space planner of record for some buildings we bought, but also Scott Ely, who was one of our leasing agents, was a big JCI supporter as well.
That's right.
So
we used to follow Scott around.
We
followed Scott and a guy named Buddy Tompkins back in the day.
Oh, yeah, I remember Buddy.
Buddy took us with him to four different real estate companies in his career, and Scott did the same about four different companies that we, you know, sort of just stayed close to Scott.
Great to have those champions. And,
the idea is when you're a good client goes to another company, we go with them, but we also keep the business that they left behind. And that's where the growth comes from.
Well, tell us, your title says president, but in your bio it says your role is actually developing new business. How's that going during the age of COVID, and have you changed any of your tactics?
That's true. My business card says president, and my name is on the door, but I do not run this firm in any stretch of the imagination. My job is to promote the firm, and my partner, Deborah Hainer, who's also my wife, is the CEO, and her job is to run the firm. So we have very different jobs to the extent that we often go days at a time without even seeing each other at work. So we still, like most married couples, we still have to catch up over dinner and, you know, how was your day?
Staying in your lane.
We definitely stay in our lanes. And we've both found for our own good and for the good of our partner, it's a good policy.
We understand.
I focus on promoting the firm, finding new friends in the real estate business, and also making sure our old friends in the real estate business don't forget about us.
So how do you find new friends comes from. In our masked age of COVID?
We're not going
to happy hours.
Our two-pronged approach to making and keeping friends has always been business lunches, and we have a beer cart, and we take our beer cart around to different real estate companies and put on happy hours, 4 o'clock, you know, happy hour on a Thursday, bringing happy hour to your desk. You know, that's our gimmick. And both of those things have been completely shut down. Nobody wants to go to lunch, and nobody wants us rolling around in their office handing out beers, even with masks on. So,
But you have been innovative and still trying to do something similar to that.
Yes, we are trying to stay in touch with our friends in the business. And we just last week tried out something that was very successful, and we'll be doing it again, which is a virtual beer tasting.
So that really happened.
Yeah,
that I saw happened. Bob go in the office, shut the door. I'm like,
That actually
happened. She didn't really believe that I was doing
business,
that.
That was a business event. And we teamed up with the Texas Ale Project, which is a great little Dallas brewery on Riverfront. And we picked up, I don't remember, many cases of their product and put together a little six-pack for each client with one each of six different beers. And we delivered all of those to our clients. And then everybody got on the same Teams call. Along with
it's a brewmaster.
She's not the brewmaster. She's the taproom manager.
Okay.
We got on with the taproom manager, who actually is a better guide for those beers, because she's communicating with the customers all the time in the tap room. So she gets a lot of feedback from people about the different beers. And so she walked us through each of the six beers, and we talked about what each one would taste good with, and everybody got thumbs up, thumbs down on each beer, and it was really fun. It was 1 hour, it was a very easy time commitment. Everyone was doing it either from their desk at the office or from their house, and no one had to go anywhere. No one had to worry about driving afterward, and it worked out great.
I'm not a beer guy, but I wanted to sit in on it anyway. So I said, thank you. Don't send me any beers because I'm not going to like them anyway. Right. So, but I'm going to sit in because I was curious about how it worked out and wanted to support you guys. And I sat in on it. I had some connectivity problems. So I dropped off and then got back on. Still had the connectivity problem. So I had to drop off after a few minutes.
Right.
But I think maybe that was a problem on my end. But
right.
I thought it was a really well done event, and it was nice to see.
Yeah, everyone had a really good time. So we're gonna do it again.
Cool.
Because
what else are you gonna do?
You're gonna work. That's what you boys are gonna do. Get back to work. Okay, help our audience understand the difference between an interior designer and an architect, and how they work together or they don't.
In Texas, the Texas Board of Architectural Examiners issues licenses or registrations to all three professions: interior design, architecture, and landscape architecture. So all three professions have a stamp and a registration and a continuing education requirement. But what we can do, what we can stamp and can't stamp, is different. So in the interior design firm, we only create construction drawings on projects that are not structural. So we're not we're not designing buildings. We're designing the space inside existing buildings that were designed by architects. And then landscape architects, of course, are limited to, they can do structural stuff, but they're limited to exterior and landscape related type projects. So we don't normally work with architects. There's not normally an architect on the team.
Because the building's already built.
For a JCI project, because the building's built and the architect's already done his job 1 to 40 years ago. He's done his job and is on to the next one. So we're 100% involved in the built environment from the inside, and we're in the middle of a $7 million tenant finish project right now that is very large, very complicated. We've got a big MEP engineer firm on board, a big structural firm, big contractor, and we're kind of running with the big boys on the interior design side. But the building that we're working in was designed by Merriman last year, which is an architecture firm.
Interesting. So, given the time we're recording this in October of 2020, we got to talk about COVID, I'm afraid. Sorry. But I noticed something interesting. You had something on your website called Safe Separation Design. I'm guessing that tab was not on your website in early March of this year. So
that is true.
So you must be doing something very specific to address COVID. So
we're trying to. This has gone through some phases as the reality sinks in on what's really happened, to the to the office design business in the last 6 months. We thought we would stay busy. You know, being all we do is design office space, right? And office space is very much up in the air right now. So we thought we would stay busy by designing the new office environment, you know, the office of the future for the new normal, mm-hmm. where everyone stays more further apart than they used to, where we have glass partitions between workstations and desks, where we have hand sanitizer stations, and we have temperature stations, and we have limits of maybe 3 or 4 people in a conference room, maybe 5 or 6 people in a break room. And all of these different changes, we thought, you know, this thing will last 3 or 4 months, but the world will be changed forever. And we'll be busy redesigning everyone's office for the new normal. And then none of those things happened. And so now we're looking at 2021 and we're thinking, okay, 21 is going to be our best year because some of our biggest projects over the years, many of our biggest projects over the years have been downsizing companies.
Oh, yeah.
Getting them into the right size space. And I kind of see the writing on the wall, and I'm, you know, talking to a lot of business owners and talking to a lot of brokers and landlords. And we think that that a lot of companies are going to come back to the office in a very different form than they left. And there's going to be a lot of companies that are going to be reducing their footprint, their office space. And there will be a lot of companies moving to less expensive real estate. So that doesn't happen just by drawing a line on a floor plan, right? And everyone moving to one side of it. More often than not, if you give up half your real estate, your office real estate, there's stuff you need that's on the other side of that line. Right.
So right.
We're going to be very busy basically redesigning companies into more efficient, smaller environments. Many of the people who've gone home aren't coming back. Some of them will. And depending on which kind of business you're in, we have a client that has sent 800 people home in March, and they're not coming back, regardless of what happens with the vaccine, with the virus. These 800 people have, you know, adapted to working at home, and they're staying.
And the company's already made that decision?
The company's already made that decision, and they've got 5 years left on their 300,000-square-foot office lease.
Wow. So they're trying to sublease, though?
Yeah, they're going to try to sublease it.
Good luck with that.
So, yeah.
I mean, we have a few clients. We have a few clients that have made that same decision.
Right.
And they're trying to sublease their space, and it's – I mean, Jan had 2 showings yesterday for one of those subleases, but the other 2 haven't had a single showing, and it's been months.
Right.
Well, the one is getting a lot of traction.
Right. That's
the
what I'm saying. The one.
You said the
right.
other. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I was just talking about the office ones. Okay. Yeah. Right. The industrial. Yeah. And yeah, we have one industrial sublease, and that's getting tons of traction. We've already sublet a big portion of it, but yeah, the office subleases, those aren't getting much traction except for the one that you showed yesterday.
So when you go and talk to these people, how do you even help walk them through how the office is going to look different? Because first of all, you've got to know their culture. You've got to know their changed culture due to COVID.
Right.
And how do you help walk them through how this is going to look? How do you assess their needs and make them understand it's okay, you can still work, but it's going to be, you know, 20%, 50% of what you had and still feel okay?
I think we've all been living kind of this under the same rules now for a long time. And there's not a whole lot of explaining to do. Everybody gets it. It's like they know what they need to do. What they need our help with is how to configure their office space to make that possible. And this office is a perfect example. This room we're sitting in was designed for 8 people, and we never have more than 4 in here now. And the room we were in before was designed for 20 people, and we never have more than 8 in that room now. So when we're designing or redesigning conference rooms, break rooms, reception areas with the reception seating. It's going to be a whole, you'll never see another sofa in a business reception area.
Oh no.
It's just not going to happen. I think long after this thing is gone or we have a vaccine and, you know, we're all trying to get back to our normal lives, there will be some things that don't change, that don't go back, because this one happened. What's to say there won't be another right. one? There probably will be another one. And so I think businesses try to plan their environments for, you know, 5 to 10 to 15 years out, I think they're going to plan them sort of around a worst case scenario. And we're just going to see less human density in the workplace. At the beginning in April and May and June, people were saying, well, hey, people are going to spread out, so they're going to need more office space, yeah. not less, right? We're right. going to need more square feet per person.
We were hanging on that for about yeah. a week.
We were too. Awesome. We're going to be, you know, we're going to see cranes on the skyline because everybody needs more space, right, to spread out. But I think that's going to be more than offset by the people who have learned not only how to do their job at home, but have learned to enjoy doing their job at home and being efficient at it. And that all depends on what business you're in.
But I look at this and say, there's never in the past been a one size fits all. You know, at the same time that I had a few years ago, a client who said, everybody's working from home, we want you in the office. At the very same time, we had other clients that were another client that did just the opposite. Said, we're right. giving up our office, everybody's going to work from home.
Right.
So I kind of have the impression that going forward, we're going to still have that. We're going to have some people that totally work out of the house. There's no office. Others that'll still have everybody in the office. And a lot of people, and probably the majority, who have some sort of a hybrid model where some work from home, right. some work from the office. Maybe they have different teams that, you know, team A's in 3 days a week and team B's in 2 days a week. Are you seeing evidence of that happening, or is
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it is. It's very different across the board depending on the industry.
Okay.
Our industry is a good example of one that does not work well when everybody's at home. We work in teams. We're a creative group, and we work together on the same projects at the same time, and the physical sharing a room, the physical back and forth of overhearing each other's phone calls and talking back and forth about a project. That's group teams or groups of 2 to 5 people, and it doesn't work as well on Teams or Zoom or yeah. GoToMeeting. It doesn't work as well. Our meetings with our clients have been less effective and less efficient and less productive and less successful doing them virtually.
Well, yeah, that beer cart's not rolling around.
Yeah, exactly.
Most importantly.
Right.
Without the beer cart.
Sign on the dotted
Some
line.
Meetings are better virtual, but most meetings in our business are not as good. They're not. It just doesn't work as well when you're creating an office environment together if you're not together.
I can see that, because yesterday I sent out an RFP to 5 buildings for a client. And the client had not toured any of them. Well, I take that back. One of the RFPs was to renew their current lease.
Right.
The other 4 were to move to a new building. And so I've been getting these phone calls from leasing agents today saying, wait a minute, Bob, you sent me this RFP, but they haven't even toured the building.
Right.
How's this going to work? And I was like, I know, it's kind of a weird thing.
Right.
But they have a travel ban. So the right. decision makers in California can't come here.
Right.
So we went through a Zoom call, and I showed them floor plans and pictures and all this kind of thing of the building, so they had a good idea of what kind of building it was. Now, they're going to have to totally renovate the space. So the configuration of the space wasn't so much the issue. It was, do we like the building? Do we like the location? Do we like the amenities of the building? And then we'll hire somebody like JCI to right. build out the right thing.
But I love what a full-service broker you are. Bob put on roller skates and a GoPro helmet. And skated through the space so they could get that feel. That, I mean, that's how far we will go to take care of our clients.
That's awesome. I would love to see me doing that, actually. That sounds like fun. I love roller skating.
It's a good idea, though, so you don't have
focus.
That. You don't have that.
Would they still play Ohio Players Fire if while I'm doing that and I'm bouncing and dancing?
Okay, Andy, walk us through the steps of the process of a space plan to like project completion, especially in today's view, because I'm assuming most of your work is retrofitting rather than new build.
Yes, I would say 80% of the spaces that we work on, that we design, have been occupied before. They're second generation.
Yeah.
Nobody says third or fourth or fifth generation.
No.
It's either
right.
Shell or second generation.
It's used,
right?
Or it's new.
Right. Yeah.
New is
count. So the first step, we call a test fit. And if you're out looking for office space, you probably are going to narrow down your search to two or three buildings, and that's the short list. We'll come in as the tenant's designer and test fit them in two or three different buildings. We'll draw a space plan that meets their requirements in each of those locations. I've never actually seen the shape or efficiency of a building be the one factor that made or broke the deal. We can work around almost anything. So if there's something about a building that makes it a little less efficient, we just work harder, you know, on that particular space plan. So our goal is to take architecture out of the equation. In other words, whichever building you pick, for the reasons you pick it, we can make your space work, and we can create a great environment for you in that building.
But don't you see in that situation that if somebody's choosing among three buildings to fit the number of people they're trying to fit into that space, that the square footage could vary considerably from one building to the next, depending on the shape of the building and the way, you know, it has sawtooth on one side or whatever. I've seen where the add-on factor, the right. common area factor can make a big difference in, you know, if you need 10,000 square feet and one building has a 12% factor and one has an 18% factor,
right.
That means the rentable square footage that they're paying on is going to be higher because of that. But does right. the shape of the building not sometimes require more space for the same number of people?
Only in cases where you have a very unusual shape. You have a very sharp pointed triangle building or a curvy building, or if you have a building that has unusually shallow bay depths,
right,
where we're just not able to make the most efficient use of the depth of the space.
And but, the bay depth is basically from the core where the restrooms and everything are to the curtain wall, to
right.
to the outside windows.
Right.
That's considered a bay depth.
90% of the office buildings out there are rectangular, and they're you know, at least 30 feet deep from the you know curtain wall to the core. There's very rarely an instance where the geometry of a building knocks it out of the running because it's an inefficient shape. There's just not that many weird shaped buildings out there.
You know, it's funny you say that because we were in San Antonio this last weekend and we're on the Riverwalk on our kayak and we see the Frostbank tower there. And I look to Jan and I say, you know, that's a really interesting looking building from an architectural standpoint, but I bet you that would be hell to lay out from a space plan for
right.
clients because it's
right.
such an odd shape. It's like,
right.
I don't know, eight sides to it or
right.
10 sides to it when it's kind of a circle, but it's sort of at a zigzag kind of thing.
Right.
It looks like it would be difficult. I'd love to see some space plans of that building
right.
to see what people have actually
right.
done.
We so. Can name a few buildings in this market, but we won't.
Come on, Andy. Do it.
The okay. next step on that is the formal space plan that normally becomes an attachment to the lease. That's a little more detail. Then we go to a pricing plan and notes, which is, again, it's like we keep adding layers to this thing, right? And on the pricing plan and notes, we're making some assumptions about the finish out so that the contractor can arrive at a preliminary estimate for what the cost will be of the finish out. And once the lease is done, we move into construction drawings and design development. And again, we're adding more layers. Now we're designing the lighting and the electrical and the finishes that go in each room. And all that's going into one big set of construction drawings. We'll then bring in an MEP engineer to design the air conditioning systems, the electrical circuitry, and the plumbing risers. And once all that's done, that goes into one big package, gets sent to the city for a permit, and actually gets built.
And all along that way, you know, as a tenant rep, we are trying to make sure that our client's getting the best deal. So if the landlord, let's say, has given us an allowance, let's just say they give us $35 a foot for improvements. Now we, as the tenant agents and the tenant themselves and their project manager, if they have one, we have to make sure that we know how much that's going to cost before they sign the lease. Because who wants to sign a lease not knowing what all their costs are? Or conversely, if it's a turnkey deal where the landlord's delivering it in a finished condition that meets the tenant's requirements, well, now the landlord needs to get that priced and make sure they know. So sometimes we end up in a situation where we have the space plan and somebody, you know, the general contractor's given us an estimate on based on that. Now that general contractor's having to make a lot of assumptions. Right. As to, you know, what kind of carpet are we going to use? What kind of countertops are we going to have, et cetera, et cetera. So if you do a pricing plan, now you've added more detail, which makes that estimate more accurate. But it's still not going to be 100% accurate until those construction documents are done, if we get that far. Not every project gets to actual construction documents. If it's like a second generation rebuild, sometimes they build straight off of the pricing plan. Do you have any feel for what percentage go pricing plan on second generation, of course, any new space has never been built out before has to have full construction documents. But on second generation, I mean, is it 50%, 75% that goes all the way to construction documents versus building off of something less?
No, I would say of the projects that get built, 80 or 85% of them are being built still off of construction drawings with a permit. There was a time when people were building more and more office suites off of preliminary drawings without a permit. The problem with that is if you don't get a permit, you also don't get a CO. And then when you go to sell your building, you've got a bunch of tenants in the building who don't have COs, and that's a problem. And it's very difficult to get a CO after the fact when you've already broken the law.
Well, I was
going to admit to it.
I was going to ask that because I've seen many situations where somebody will say, we're going to sign the lease and go pull a permit. A CO, certificate of occupancy from the city. They get a certificate of occupancy for the space as it currently sits.
Right.
Now they have the city approval to occupy the space.
Right.
But they have every intention to do renovations after the fact.
Right.
Whether or not they pull a permit on that is, you know, open to discussion, each one.
Yeah.
So you're saying if somebody pulls up that CO, gets that permission to occupy the space, and then they build out the space without getting a permit at that point, that could create a difficult time for the next occupant later on when they go to get a permit or to get a CO?
Yes, because the city keeps, you know, on file whatever the most current floor plan is that they know about. So on the next CO, when they send their team out to inspect the space, it doesn't match what they have on file, so they know something has happened.
Okay.
Now, they can't really – there's not a lot they can do about it at that point. We're assuming this is, you know, years later.
Right.
But the other reason not to do it that way is that you want inspections. Permits trigger inspections, and both sides, the tenant and the landlord – want inspections. You want a building inspector coming out and looking at your electrical work, looking at your framing, looking at your plumbing, looking at your mechanical, making sure everything's up to code and safe.
Yeah.
Because
the consequences are pretty stark.
If there's a problem, if there's a fire, if there's an active shooter, if there's any kind of reason where everybody has to get out right now and they can't, or somebody gets hurt in the process, the process is going to be looked at. It's going to be looked at very meticulously all the way back to the beginning.
We have
the
a client.
The first question is going to be, have you ever done any construction in this building or in this space without a permit?
And the answer is yes. We both know certain landlords.
Yes.
I mean, we had a client that a few years ago that called me up and said, Bob, we have smoke in our space. And it looks like it's coming from above the drop ceiling in the plenum. And I went over there immediately, and this was a landlord that owned a few buildings, and he never once, to my knowledge, pulled a permit. He wanted to do everything turnkey. He had his good old boy guy who did all the work.
Right.
It was a nightmare. And I told this client, I said, look, you're number one, you got people packed in here like crazy. Mm-hmm. And number two, this guy's not pulling permits. I really worry what happens someday. And what was interesting is they moved out. We moved them out of the building, fortunately, later. That landlord tried to sell his buildings, I think, last year. And, man, those things were not trading. While everything else was selling quickly, these buildings weren't trading. And I promise you, a big factor of that was when people came in and do their inspections,
right,
they saw there were no permits, there were no COs.
Right.
Things. I mean, you pull above that, pull out a ceiling tile, I bet it was just a rat's nest up there of all kinds of wires.
And right.
It was scary.
And an institutional buyer
can't
close on something like that.
No.
Right? There's too much risk.
Well, so what is – you mentioned whenever you work with a tenant that you're planning for multiple buildings. I know a lot of times the landlord has a, quote, architect or space planner of record for that building. And that person, that company does most of the work in that building. But you're really advocating instead of the landlord dictating who it is. So, if I have a client, instead of us having to go to five buildings with five different architects or space planners, you're saying we should really have only one space planner representing the tenant who does all the work in all those buildings. And the advantage to the tenant is what?
I say it differently than that. What I always advise, tenant rep brokers is always use the landlord's space planner, provided it's JCI.
Okay, I was waiting for this real wisdom. Okay.
Because sometimes you get lucky. The building your client is interested in is a JCI asset. So the general kind of thinking is that there might be a conflict of interest if the space planner who's designing your tenant's space has a relationship, fiduciary and otherwise, with the landlord.
Right.
That is not true, in my opinion. Because where design is concerned, both the tenant and the landlord want the same thing from the space planner. In other areas, there's conflicts galore, right? Where the tenant wants one thing and the landlord wants something completely different. Parking or term or rate or whatever it is, whatever those variables are. But when it comes to design, they both want the same thing. They want a beautifully done, creative, efficient space that can be built inside the allowance, right? So as long as we're doing that, as long as we're being creative, not only finding creative ways to design space, but finding creative ways to not spend money, to not tear things down needlessly.
Value engineering.
And we're also designing to the budget, right? We know what the budget is going in. And if we don't know, we ask. In fact, we insist. We won't design a project if they won't tell us what the budget is, what the allowance or the tenant's contribution is. And so if that's the case, then it really doesn't matter. If I'm your space planner, it doesn't matter who I know, who I'm friendly with, who's sending me business, on the other side of the office. We want the same thing the landlord wants and the same thing the tenant wants. We want it to be beautiful.
True.
We want it to be a wonderful office, and we want it to get built inside the budget.
So, that's good to hear that you don't perceive there to be any conflict of interest regardless of who the tenant uses or whichever architect or space planner is being used. From a tenant's perspective, since we only represent tenants, I think it's in the tenant's best interest to have a space planner, interior designer, architect on their side, only because they don't want to have to go through five different space planning meetings with five different groups for each of those buildings if they're all different. They want to have one person who understands their requirements very well and then implements those and designs those in all the buildings instead of a different one. So it just reduces the amount of time it takes for them to do it that way. So
so exactly where does Andy come into the equation? If I'm out shopping for new space, when do you call them?
Well, I think it depends a lot on the size of the tenant. So if we are shopping in big office buildings that are 200,000 square feet or bigger, and we're with a 2,000 square foot tenant, we may not have the power to force that landlord to use who we want to use. But if you're with a 20,000 foot tenant or more, then yeah, you definitely have that power. So it can be done both ways. Now, I know Andy has a client who is a tenant rep who pretty much insists on JCI for every deal. And regardless of size, and you say he's been
most
very
recently 1,400 square feet this week.
I mean, good for him. I mean, that's awesome. And he's doing that even in pretty big office buildings, right?
Yes. This particular broker lost his sidekick, lost his protege.
Oh no.
She left and went to do something else and left him a list of deals that she was working that he calls the Island of Misfit Toys. So we've got this list of sort of random deals that they're half done. So he has to finish them.
Yeah.
You know, he can't just tell them,
dump them.
We're not going to represent you anymore.
So they're a little smaller than he would like, it sounds like.
A little smaller than anyone would like.
We are not best equipped to meet your needs.
Hey, in COVID, 1,400 feet, on some days that looks pretty darn good.
And I told him that too.
So who is your ideal client?
We have always, from the very beginning, focused on really two ideal clients. There's two ideal people that we want to know and work with long term. One is the leasing representative for an office building or a portfolio of office buildings who works for a real estate company and leases office space for a living. And the other is the tenant rep broker who's representing tenants out there and helping them find office space or industrial space or medical office space or retail space. And so those people don't normally wind up actually being our client. They're not signing our check, obviously.
Right.
That's not who our contract is with, but that's where almost all of our business comes from, is one of those two people. In a few cases, property managers have sway over who the design firm will be on a given project, but it's almost always decided very early by either the leasing agent or the tenant rep broker. And that's who we try to stay close to.
It's funny you say that because when I was an asset manager on the landlord side, I used to say that the tenant was not my primary client. You know, for landlords, the primary client is the investor that gives them the money to buy the building, the equity.
Right.
That's their number one client, because if they don't get that money, they don't get to buy a building. Nothing else matters. Their secondary client then is the tenant rep, because the tenant rep is going to bring them the opportunity for multiple deals over a year or two, 3 years.
Right.
The tenant then, while they're the ones actually writing the check for the rent, which pays the mortgage, which gives the return to the investors, et cetera, while they're doing all that, they're only going to sign a deal once every 5 years on average.
Right.
And so there's no new revenue possible once that lease is signed from that tenant, probably. A few will expand, but not most of them. So I kind of show that pecking order to clients, and they're kind of surprised at first, clients being the actual tenant, my primary client now.
Yeah, it sounds like the government and taxes.
Right.
It's depressing.
Well, it kind of sounds depressing, but if you understand what the landlord's true business is, it's buying buildings and creating value.
It's what we like to call leveling the playing field. You impart this knowledge to the tenant, which they need to know.
Sure.
So they understand the landlord's desires and why it's that way.
Exactly. So anyway, they kind of trade up on the food chain of that three-prong, client list. And they go from being number three to number two by having a tenant rep representing them. They're never going to get to number one unless they actually invest in a building. Right. But, and I actually, last year we did have that happen. We actually were going to be working with a client who was going to be moving from a building to another building. But one of his best friends turned out to be an investor, bought a building and said, hey, if you'll sign a lease in this building, I'll give you a piece of the building. So now he was going to be not only the tenant, but also an investor in the building. So
right.
We got totally cut out of that deal,
yeah.
Which makes perfect sense. I mean, I wasn't excited about that.
It didn't to me.
But I thought it made sense. Sometimes Jan and I don't always see eye to eye on those things.
I'm vice president of ops. I put the checks in the bank. You take them out. There's a dichotomy there. Okay, Billy Bob, we have trivia time.
Okay.
Did you know that Andy is a private pilot working on getting his commercial license?
I did not know the pilot part until you told me this a couple of days ago. And I didn't know about the commercial part till this morning when Andy told us that. So that's pretty cool. What drove the whole pilot interest?
I've wanted to be a pilot since as long as I can remember. I grew up in the Air Force. My dad was a pilot. I always wanted to be a pilot like my dad. And I kind of got distracted while I was in college and discovered architecture and followed it. Got a degree, got a job, got married, had some babies, you know, kept working, trying to make more money, you know, started a firm. And all this time I was, you know, thinking, well, you know, I'd still like to be a pilot. And so there never seemed to be the time or the money to pursue that. And I obviously wasn't going in the Air Force, so there wasn't going to be any free training.
A little late.
So on my 50th birthday, my wife gave me my first three flying lessons as a birthday gift. And I literally started my first lesson was the day after my 50th birthday.
Nice.
And decided to pursue this, you know, sort of lifelong dream in the fall of my life. So I took lessons for a year, got my private license, bought an airplane. I have a 1960 model Cessna. And her name is in our house, all vehicles have names. Everything has a name. And so the airplane's name is Maggie May, after the Rod Stewart song, because mm-hmm. Maggie is older than I am, and she stole my heart.
At least your wife knows where to go looking for your mistress, well, right? It's in the hangar. Well,
we kid around about that because she stays in a hangar in Terrell. And when you open the hangar door, the morning sun shining in through the hangar door really shows her age.
Oh, gosh.
That's awesome.
So there are lots of reasons why Maggie's the perfect name for this.
You know, I wanted to be a pilot growing up as well. And actually, both high schools that I went to were available to me was flight training. They had a little airport there.
Right.
And they were learning on the Cessnas.
Right.
But my dad was afraid of flying. I grew up an Army kid. So okay. My dad was an Army officer.
Okay.
So he was not a flyer. He did not like flying.
Right.
And of course, being in the military, no extra cash. I mean, I was already going to boarding school. So to try and add flight training to that was not in the cards. So I've never become a pilot. I'm still not a pilot. Doubt I'll ever be a pilot at this point. But that's pretty cool that you went ahead and did it.
It's not as dangerous as people think.
No.
Mile for mile, general aviation is only 10 times more dangerous than driving your car.
Wait a minute. It's 10 times more dangerous?
Yes, it is. It is dangerous. Don't get me wrong. Flying is dangerous.
You're talking about little planes. I mean, because the big planes is actually more safe than cars, I heard.
Yes, it is. If you're talking about airlines, that's different.
All right, but it's getting in a plane with a guy who didn't get his license until he was in his 50s. That's when it gets dangerous.
And driving are called Maggie
that's
May.
That's when it gets dicey. But even corporate jets and that kind of thing is all considered general aviation. Everything
yes.
but airlines is or military.
Oh,
is
I got
general
you.
General aviation.
So 10 times. That's a real. That's a real stat.
You know, my life insurance rates will demonstrate that the actuarials you know, there's some risk there.
Should have taken that policy out on your 50th birthday, so right. You didn't have to fill in that question right, on right. the app.
Yeah, actually the question was, are you or are you planning take flying lessons?
Intent
that's
is all.
A specific question yeah. with this particular company. So
interesting.
And along with bungee jumping and all that.
Or getting COVID. Yeah, they've got all those apps now. Andy, thank you so much for your time. You've given our listeners a lot to think about. And to our listeners, thanks for listening to another episode of the Confessions of a Recovering Landlord podcast. At Riata Commercial Realty, we will wear a GoPro and skates if we need to, while we exclusively serve companies that lease or purchase office and warehouse space. We never represent landlords. Find us at texastenantrep.com or call us at 972-667-0028.
Andy, how do people want to find you if they want to talk to you or learn about the company?
At ajci.com, Andy Jones Commercial Interiors, ajci.com.
That's
the best way.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And listener, we'd love for you to leave us a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcast or wherever you're listening to this. That'll help other people find us. Be back next week. Thanks.
Thank you.